Okay. So the title of this shiur is Chetamina Satire and Sefer Shoftim, which is the moderate version of the title. Right, last year it was Is Sefer Shoftim a Feminist Satire? I got in a little trouble for that. So now we're just making it part of the book and not the entire book. I think before I set out the thesis, right, so it's worth defining what a satire is. Okay, because certainly one begins to get in trouble if one assumes that satires aren't true. Okay, so the first thing I want to make clear is that I don't in any way claiming that there are satiric elements in Sefer Shoftim does not in any way imply that Sefer Shoftim isn't historically true. It means the story is told in a way which makes fun of certain things. Okay, all of you know that you can retell something in a way which is sympathetic to the people you're telling the story about, or you can retell the story in a way which makes a tremendous amount of fun of the people, and the facts are exactly the same. Okay, so my argument is that Sefer Shoftim retells the events that occur in the book with the intent of making fun of some things. Okay, and also make clear that satires aren't necessarily uproariously funny in the sense that you're supposed to come happy, right? There is such a thing as a bleak satire, right? We end up, right, just thinking everything's really bad, right? But, you know, and all it does is break down your sympathy for things you might otherwise have sympathy with. It doesn't necessarily mean you have a good time reading it, right? Especially if you care about the issues associated with it. Right? So when I claim that there is satire in Sefer Shoftim, it doesn't mean it's not true. It doesn't mean that that you were supposed to be laughing out loud hysterically while reading the story. It means that you're supposed to understand that a lot of things are supposed to be read with a certain degree of irony. Okay, and that sometimes things which are presented as if they were straightforward, but if you think about them are really ridiculous, you're supposed to think about them. And you're supposed to realize they're ridiculous, right? And you're not betraying the narrator of the story if you think of something as ridiculous, which it seems that he's presenting as straightforward. Okay, that's just to define the terms at the outset. There are certain things which we don't have time to go into in the story of Pelagish Begiva, which give you a sense that what's going on is not just telling a story straightforwardly. For example, and you can check me on this later, you'll discover that much of the language of Perek Yutet is taken from a different story in Tanakh. Right? Anybody figure out what the language of Perek Yutet is supposed to remind you of? What other story happens like that, where people stop someplace for hospitality, and the result of stopping for hospitality is that the entire town comes and surrounds them, apparently seeking to sexually molest them. Where else does that happen? Stone, right? When the angels stop with Lot. Okay, so from the very outset, right, you know, the whole language of the story of Pelegish B'Givah is taken from the story of Lot and the angels, and that tells you from the very beginning that the character, right, that the people here, right, the people of the tribe of Benjamin, right, are the people of stone. Okay, and that it doesn't change the facts at all, but it already tells you the narrator is using techniques aside from just telling the story to let you know what's going on. Okay, that, right, with the irony built in, of course, that the man goes there because he thinks, oh, Bnei Yisrael, right, they're the good place, they're the safe place, as opposed to the other inhabitants, right, who might very well be, right, we could go to stone, but no, we wouldn't want to do that, right, because they're evil, we're going to go to the tribe of Binyamin, right, where of course you have Yerushalayim, right, that's where we're going to go, right, that's where we're going to go, everywhere we're going to be safe. Okay, so to begin with, right, there are ironies which are, I think, clear in the story, which should predispose you to believing, right, that this kind of tactic is used throughout the story. Okay, so I'm just taking that as the beginning of a justification for reading the story this way. Right, that there are, I think, fairly explicit elements of irony and satire that if you just look for them are there. Okay, so now let's talk about what the point of this story is, and then put it in the context of Sefer Shoftim as a whole. And I'm going to start by, which I think Ariella mentioned during the Chavruta period, right, the conclusion of the book is by Yamim Ahem and Ein Melech B'Yisrael, Isha Yashar Beinav Yaseh. Right, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was good in his eyes. And we can argue later about whether the Ish means men or every person, right, which might matter or might not matter. So the thesis of Sefer Shoftim, right, as set up, is that everything would be better if only there were a king. Right? The reason everything goes wrong is because there's no king, right? And this is repeated several times in Sefer Shoftim, right? Sefer Shoftim is the period of anarchy, right, where there's no king. And of course, we know that as soon as there was a king in Israel, everything went right, right? Right, all of Sefer Melachim and Sefer Divrei Hayamim, right, and Sefer Shmuel was all about how everything was perfect once there was a king, right? Is that your recollection of how Sefer Melachim ended? That's why we all still live in Israel with a temple, right? Because there was a king and everything was solved, and we lived happily ever after.
Is it referring to a
person king? Yeah, I assume a person king. Right, that's what I mean. You can argue, well, theologically, it's because God wasn't king, but it looks like a critique of the political structure and not of the religious structure. Yes, yeah. Wait. Yeah, and Sefer Shmuel, right? And Sefer Shmuel, right? The whole denunciation, what's wrong with you people is you want a king, right? So now we could just postulate that there's this huge conflict between Sefer Shoftim and Sefer Shmuel. Right, or that Sefer Shmuel, Shoftim was written earlier when they were naive and they thought kings would solve the problem. And 100 years later, whoever wrote Sefer Shoftim would say, "Whoops, that wasn't it at all." Right, I'd rather not say that. Yes, Ariel.
Isn't it possible that they're just using the word king because that's what order was back then? That's who imposed order. That's who made the rules, so to speak. In those places, and what they were lacking was order, not necessarily a king and all the king stuff. Everything that goes with it. But just order in general, a law, a rule.
Okay, good.
Statement one. This is another thing. Okay. And that is that they didn't really never have a king. They still want to be like everybody else. They want the king, but the problem is they want the king for one reason.
So they only want it, right? So.
They only want the king to be like everybody else. Not that they wanted workers, that they wanted the key, with all the other, special trappings of the king and the law.
Okay. Right, so you want to argue that really, what he should say, if in those days, there wasn't a king and the people didn't want the king, right, and the people who wanted a king wanted it for the wrong reason.
Yeah, okay.
You could work on that. I'm willing to accept the first thesis, certainly, as working in order, right, which is, it's not the personality of the king which is critical, right, but the king is, what the king reflects, a breakdown of social order. But the absence of a king means there's a breakdown of social order. And in fact, what goes on in what goes wrong later on, right, in Melachim and in Shmuel, is rarely chaos, right? What goes wrong there is Avodah Zarah, right? So two different types of problems. And as I say, Sefer Shoftim is about, but even though Sefer Shoftim has elements of Avodah Zarah in it, right, the second to last story is all about Avodah Zarah, right? But fundamentally, the critique of what goes wrong in Sefer Shoftim is not a critique of the theology of the population, right? But it tells you that whatever goes wrong in Sefer Shoftim is a product of the lack of social order, which is not to say that social order doesn't have its own problems, but that's what's going wrong in Sefer Shoftim.
But also, I think when it says that there's no king, it's referring more to it, not because there's not a king, it's because people don't even want a king. Even if there was, it's each man for himself, they don't have an ideal that they're striving for either. They don't think there is an ultimate ideal set of rules to follow. Okay, so king means an objective set of norms, not just social order.
Okay, Jenny, what do you want to say?
The only point at which I can recollect that people ask for a king in Shoftim is when they ask for Gideon,
right,
to be their king. So it seems like, from what I remember, The only one point at which the people actually ask for a king is a real problem, Shoftim, is a real bizarre, that they're worshipping idols, and then it's not until the end of the book that the narrator attacks on that there's no king, and I've only read some of the Shoftim Shmuel, so I don't really know Melachim so well, but it seems like it's sort of the narrator's take on Shoftim, maybe just at the end, about kings being an issue, but my reading is that the narrator, along the way, real issue is about that.
The Gideon story is interesting because, right, he thinks that because Gideon claims that kingship is a bad idea, right? But I'm working on the perspective of a unified narrator, right? So that is right. So that narrator, so right. So I might disagree with him if I want, but the narrator's perspective somehow is that one. But even though I might very well have thought based on the story the problems of Avodah Zarah, right? But the narrator tells us that the real problem is lack of kingship. Correct. Right, but I want to make another point. When does this story happen? Okay, relative to the narrative of Sefer Shoftim, right? When does this story happen? Is this right? This is the end of Sefer Shoftim, but chronologically, when does it happen? Presumably not at the end of Sefer Shoftim, right? If you look at Reich, it presumably happens somewhere in the middle of Sefer Shoftim, right? If it
happens.
Yeah.
So.
You know, try and date it, right? You'll figure, right? You know, there's nothing in the story which dates it. Right? There's nothing in the story at all which dates it. Right? If you figure out, your best guess will be somewhere in the middle of the period of the judges. Right? There's no attempt made to fit it into the narrative flow. Okay, there's no attempt made to tell you this is where it happens. My suggestion, therefore, is that it's deliberately pulled out of the narrative of Sefer Shoftim and placed at the end to tell you that this is the story through which you should understand everything else that happened in Sefer Shoftim. Right, and therefore, that the climax, the thematic line of Ayim Ha'im Ein Melech B'Yisrael, right, happens at the capstone of this story, and the book is not a coincidence. Right, because Sefer Shoftim is told out of order. Precisely to tell, right, so you shouldn't think that this story is just one of the things that go wrong. This is the story which expresses what is wrong with Sefer Shoftim. Okay, now let's try and figure out what exactly is wrong with, right? What in this story, right, in the story of Pilagish Begiva, right, let's suppose you had a structure, you had a societal order. So what would have happened?
Thing that doesn't happen, I don't know if it would or not, is an
independent
investigation from the speech-making. And the guy
who turns over
to Kuladesh, so where does he get off being the good guy at the end who, you know,
calm. Okay. Right, so there might have been some punishment for him too, and he might just not have started the war by himself. Okay, yes?
Well, doesn't it imply that is some sort of social order, but rather than jokes that it's not working. But, by saying that, you know, no one investigated, no one sought to punish the murderers, that's implying that there was somebody who actually knew that. That there was somebody who was theoretically in charge, just not really in charge.
Well, I would argue even more sharply, right? What happens is, right, that the entire population en masse gets up and avenges the death of this woman. Right, so if what we're worried about is a lack of justice, right, it happens. Who needs a king, right, if the entire population as one? Right, suppose the tribe of Benjamin, right, behaved the exact same way, right, it sheltered a murderer. Right, what would the king do? The king would get everyone else together. Now the king would get everyone else together, and the king, right, and the king would start a war against the tribe of Benjamin. That's what a king should do, right? So fundamentally, right, it's very peculiar, I think, that this story is chosen as the critique, right, with the absence of a central authority, when in fact everyone, right, in terms of that story, everyone does exactly what they're supposed to. What better reaction could you ask?
That's the opposite end, like, at the same time, having different people that's going against social order, like, it doesn't seem like it's just like one murder. It's a whole group of people saying, what are you doing to get to impact?
Right. The whole tribe of Benjamin is wrong, right? Everyone else gets up and says, this is terrible. Right? And they wipe them out, great. Right? I don't see what's wrong. Yes, it is.
How is it that everyone, like, what you said, like, just happened en masse? But that's exactly the way that the word happens. And, like, that's the way that things don't work under like, if someone does something wrong, it's under, like, you know, in the hierarchy, at the so, like, every like, girl and a man who death or a man, like, whatever, went down wrong. Like, the king, the guy, the people do it. The whole society doesn't do it. So, I mean, I think the showing of the level of social order is, like, is showing just as much in the punishment of the, you know, of the people who did wrong as the perpetrators, as much as, you know.
Why is what happens to the perpetrators wrong?
Because to have, it starts out with this horrible thing that takes a whole, you know, tribe,
we grace this person. And then, in an even weirder thing, the whole rest of the society somehow gets involved in punishing them. That's totally bizarre. It's not right, because that's not the way it's supposed to be. Like, that if someone does something wrong, your job is
it's not a regular citizen job. It's not individuals. They have a democratic meeting, right? So they vote, right? They function like a really good democracy. The entire population gets together, right? Like the Athenian assembly, right? All the citizens get together. They vote. What better system could there be?
Yeah, that's irrational. I say that a certain segment of the society does something wrong.
Isn't that what democracy is?
No. Democracy is saying that we, you know, live in this society where we all, you know, vote for our government, and then
so we delegate someone.
Right, and we delegate the person to be in charge, and then when something goes wrong, that person choosing what to do about it.
Okay, I don't know why that's better. Why it's better to have the representative of the population do it than the people making the decision themselves.
I see this totally it's just as much going to your weak instinct.
Okay, so fundamentally what you're really saying is you like republics and not democracies. Right? If you don't like real, you don't like pure. No, real democracy, right? The distinction between democracy and republic is precisely that, right? In republics, the people elect other people, right? Because you don't trust the mob, right? And you build in precautions against the mob, like the Constitution, right? It protects minorities. In democracies, everyone votes.
Well, that's a good thing.
Okay, so you don't like democracy.
Real democracy. Any real democracy is great, yeah.
Okay, you don't like it. That's fine. It's a fine position, right? And what you're saying is perfectly there in Aristotle and Plato as well. It's perfectly reasonable. Okay. Okay.
Republics and or democracy aside, what about the fact that if it were a republic style government, that you have one person punishing another one person, and maybe 10 people or 20, however many it was. And this huge, basically, I won't say vigilante because it is sort of a democracy system, right? You were starting a war, killing a lot of people,
right,
who were not perpetrators, and a lot of people who didn't perpetrate anything.
Right. Sort of like the Civil War.
What?
Sort of like the Civil War. Which was started by a president, right, in a republic.
What?
Which was started by a president in a republic.
Well, that's another discussion for another day. The point is, right, that if there was one central government for the punishment, and there was an investigation and found out exactly who did it, a lot of those people in general, everybody, and all people are God's people, would have been killed. Lovers.
Interesting. I don't necessarily have your faith in bureaucracy.
What?
I don't necessarily have your faith in bureaucracy. Besides, what happened?
Another discussion for another day.
Okay, but what I would argue, okay, and I'll ask you to take this for now. What I would argue is that no investigation would have done any good because the tribe of Benjamin as a whole defended the murderers. And in a situation where a communal group is unwilling to allow investigation or is willing to defend the guilty parties with their own lives, so who cares who the guilty parties are? You've got to kill everyone to get to them. Right, which is what happened for a long time, right, let's say in Serbia, right, now, right, in Europe today, right, in Israel now, right, with the Palestinian Authority, right?
I was making a general argument about it.
Okay, what I want to argue is that I'm not convinced that just as it, that the issue is just a critique of different forms of government. Okay, what I want to argue is that fundamentally the critique, which Ariella said earlier, is correct, that what's wrong is social disorder. So the question is, though, what happens in a situation where there is no effective authority? Okay, what necessarily happens? And I want to argue that it's not coincident that, right, but here, so far all of you have managed to have this conversation without any reference to gender. Right? What I want to argue is that if you read the story, right, it's not really possible to talk about what's going wrong without reference to gender. Because the story begins, right, the story begins with a rape, right, the heterosexual rape, and it ends, right, and it ends with a story fundamentally of a mass heterosexual rape. There's almost a symmetry, right, where it begins, right, the second rape in the story, right, is the mass rape by the tribe of Benjamin of a specific woman, and the end of the story is the mass rape by the remainder of the tribe of Benjamin of a whole group of women. Right? Okay, right, so I would argue, right, that there's too much, right, there's too much of a focus on the role of women for what's wrong to be independent of, right, of the relationship between men and women in society. Okay? In fact, I want to argue that when you read the story, you discover there are a lot of things that are really funny in a very bitter form of way. Okay? You start with a problem, as many of you have noticed, that is that there are no good guys in the story. Right? You have a woman who commits adultery. Right? The man speaks to her and tries to get her back, but ends up turning her over for a mass rape. His reaction to her being mass raped is an incredibly callous moment, right, where he gets up and he says, "Get up," and she doesn't get up. Right? So he chops her to pieces, right? So his reaction to what happened to her is to chop her into pieces. Right? There's some controversy. My wife and I disagree strongly about whether she's dead when he chops her up into pieces or not. Right? Because you read the story, there's no proof that she's dead. Right? He says, "Get up," she doesn't get up. So he chops her to pieces. Okay, right. So I think she's dead. My wife thinks she's still alive. Maybe it's one of these cases where the point is that it wouldn't have mattered to him in the slightest. Right? Maybe she's dead, maybe she's alive, but he doesn't care. Maybe he doesn't know. Well, doesn't know. Maybe you think, okay, you can get more complicated than that. Different lecture.
So right. She's dead, so in essence, it doesn't really matter if she's dead or not.
Right. But as far as, right, it's certainly clear that he has, right, that for all his going to speak to, you know, to get her back, right, that he hasn't, right, that he has no concern for her dignity, right, because his reaction is, right, to send her out. If you assume that the narrator Sefer Shoftim knows something, right, either knows Sefer Shmuel or knows of the social mechanism of Sefer Shmuel, so you know that Shaul starts a war against the Plishtim by chopping up an ox and sending it around, right, because it seems likely that a way of starting a war was by sending a chopped up animal around. So he sent a chopped up concubine around. Right, Philly, he's not working from a perspective where her dignity is a value, right? If you know Chumash, right, so you know that Belial is, right, he's an ultimate expression of human dignity, and he doesn't give her that, right? He could have sent around a message. Okay. The rest of the population is properly aroused, right? And so they all go and they fight a war. But the peculiar thing about this war is, right, it's a war which, right, in chapter 20, which you don't have, is fought on the basis of the Urim Ketumim. Right? It's fought on the basis of the oracle. In the exact same way, by the way, right, as the opening of Sefer Shoftim. Right? Where the opening of Sefer Shoftim is discussing how to fight this war, right? And so here again, right, they go ahead, right, they fight a war. Well, there it's against the Canaanites, and here it's against the tribe of Benjamin. Right? So they fight this war, and what happens is, for 2 days, they all go up and attack Benjamin, and Benjamin wins. Even though the Urim Ketumim tell them to fight. And they're all very upset, they're trying to figure out why is this, and they go up again, right, and they ask the question more precisely, and this time God says go up because you'll win, and they go up and they win. But if it's so clear that they're right, right, why do they, right, why does God lead them into death twice in a row? Okay, it's a peculiarity of the story that they can't be quite that right, because if they were quite that right, then they would just wipe out Benjamin the first time, right? Why do they have to suffer losses in the process? Okay, that raises what I think is a critical question in the story. What do the rest of the tribes think was wrong or about what Benjamin did? Okay, why do you think they're so upset? What did they do? What did Benjamin do wrong? Okay, well, so let's try to think what, right, one possible thing they did wrong, right, was that, right, was that there was a mass rape. Right? So that's one possibly wrong, right? And we could, right, and this could be a reaction to rape. Okay? The only problem with that is, right, if that's the case, then the ultimate resolution of it, right, which is to allow them to do it again, is really, right, is really problematic. Right? So it seems deeply unlikely that what the other tribes were reacting to was the crime of rape, because of that, right, because then they would have reacted very differently. So what did they think? What did go wrong, right? So think of the parallel to stone. Okay, what's wrong about stone, right? What value is stone, if the people of stone pervert? Hospitality, right? All right, so what's wrong, right? So my contention is that from the perspective of the other tribes, what went wrong in Binyamin was that they abused and killed the guests. Okay? Pardon? Well, the man himself, right? In terms of, right, the man himself, right, the man sent out his concubine the way Lot offers to send out his daughters, by the way, right? But there are no angels, right? There are no angels to pull him, to pull him back at the door, right? But that's, yeah. Yeah, they own the guy, absolutely, right?
Like you said, the guy didn't mind that he didn't, like, personally care for the concubine, and that's why he cut her up. He obviously minded that he cut her up.
Yeah, he's insulted.
Right, and he does not.
Right. Exactly, exactly, right? So what they think is wrong, right, is here this perfectly innocent man comes, right, who expects hospitality, and what do? They rape his concubine. Right, that's terrible. We can't allow this. Okay, right. So my understanding of the story, right, is that from their perspective, right, what the war is being fought about is the perversion of hospitality by the tribe of Binyamin. And the proof of it is that their resolution, right, that the resolution for this is, right, is the end of it is, you know, if they're willing to create another, right, they're willing to create another mass rape, that's fine. Right, so my contention further is, right, that the narrator tells you that God understands what is really wrong is the rape, right, and what's wrong is, right, because God has them lose the war the first couple of times, right, to try and get them to understand, you know what, you're fighting this, it's the right war for the wrong reason, and it's only when they demonstrate that they're invincibly ignorant of this, that there's no way they can think about it, well, the truth is they're more right than the other guy, so they win. Okay, but fundamentally what goes on in this story, right, is that no one understands what's wrong. Okay, the man, sees his concubine as an object. Right, the people of Binyamin see the concubine as an object. Right, the tribe of Israel and the tribe, right, Binyamin and the rest of Israel have a fight about, right, whether concubines are property to the point that, right, that they're collective property, or whether they're individual property. Right? Where the man and the rest of Israel think that they're individual property and therefore you have obligations not to maltreat them if they come in as the property of somebody else. Right? Whereas the Naaman thinks, no, right, they're just property. So why should I be one person's property as opposed to another? Right? It's entirely clear that the rest of Israel doesn't understand it anymore because the rest of Israel spends their time giving away women to Naaman. Right, let's wipe out all the men of Yavesh Gilad and we'll give their women to Binyamin. Right, if that doesn't work, there still aren't enough women, so let's save Binyamin by giving them some of our women, right, and they can kidnap. Okay, right, so my contention is that if you read the story, you understand the narrator's perspective on what's going on for all the characters, right, is that none of the characters understand that what is really wrong with this society is that none of them understand that women are people. Okay? Now, the question one then has to ask is, okay, what does that have to do with Isha Yashar Bein Av Taseh? Imim Haimim Melech B'Yisrael Isha Yashar Bein Av Taseh. Okay, if what's wrong is a fundamental failure to understand proper relationship between genders, so why do you connect that to the political order? Okay, because, right, you could have a king right? When you look at what kings do, right? There's no particular sense that kings are necessarily better in their treatment of women than anybody else. Okay. So, I want to set up. Someone have a watch, by the way, so anywhere. Can I borrow it for the duration? Okay, I got it. Thank you. Okay, so we've got about 10 minutes, so I'm going to have to ram through this, and then you'll spend the rest of your lives trying to figure out if I'm right or not. Okay, what I want to argue is as follows. Presumption of Sefer Shoftim, right, is that, and we can debate whether this is still true now, but it was unquestionably true in the historical time period of Sefer Shoftim, is that in a state of nature, men have far more power than women. Right, because men are stronger and men don't get pregnant. Right, meaning that in a world without any kind of social order, women have no chance. Right, because men are stronger and there's nothing that prevents men from exercising their power. Okay, so the reflection, what's wrong, the reflection of the anarchy in Sefer Shoftim. Right, and possibly what's most wrong about the anarchy in Sefer Shoftim is that anarchy inevitably leads to a situation in which men have complete power and women have no influence at all. Okay, right. So in the name in Melech Bisrael, Ish Hayashar Beinav Yaseh. Right. In those days, there's no king. Therefore, men can do whatever they want, and that leads to a situation in which women are property. Okay. Taking that as a premise, right? So I'm arguing, right, that the thesis of the end of the book, right, is that at least the critical symptom and possibly what's really wrong with all of the culture of Sefer Shoftim is that gender relationships are distorted by the absence of any kind of authority, which leads inevitably to the subjugation of women, right? Even an evil central authority, right, is likely to be better for in terms of gender relations because, right, at least because one of the functions of an authority is going to be all inevitably to protect women against men. Right? Because at least men will, right, because at least when there's a central authority, men will protect their women against other men. And there'll be some kind of control. Okay. Now if you accept my premise that that's what the end of Sefer Shoftim is about, and that it's placed at the end of Sefer Shoftim precisely because it's supposed to express the point of the book, so you would expect this theme to be reflected throughout the book. Okay, my contention is that if you go through a whole series of episodes in Sefer Shoftim, you'll discover, right, that this is in fact true, right, that this is a theme which shows up throughout Sefer Shoftim. Okay, we'll start with Perek Aleph. Okay, if you turn to the third page of the packet. Okay, so, Vayelech Yudach Elakani Yashev B'Chevron, V'Shem Chevron L'Fanim Kiryat Arba, Vayaku Et Sheshai Adachiman V'Yatzalmai. Okay, so Yehuda attacks Canaan, and they attack these people, and they go to Devir, which used to be Kiryat Sefer. And so Kalev says, right, anyone who destroys Kiryat Sefer, I will get Achsa, my daughter, as a wife. Okay, this may be the same kind of problem already, or may not be. I don't know. Okay, so Athniel ben Kenaz, right, Achi Kalev captures it, and he gets Achsa as a wife. Okay, and so when she comes, so she seduces him to ask her father for the field, and then right, she charms her father into giving him water. Right, so the episode is right. He goes and he conquers the city. Right, and at the end of it, right, she gets her father to give him water. So I want to argue, right, this is the opening, right, this is the opening of Sefer Shoftim. I want to argue that perhaps this provides a counterpoint, right, because what happens is a guy fights a war, right, at the end of it, he wins this wonderful place, and what happens? He wins this wonderful place, but it's totally useless, because he wins this wonderful desert, and he fights a war to get a desert, right, and it's only when, right, and it's only his wife who comes up with the idea, you know what, perhaps we should get water. Yeah, right. And that's what makes the whole right. What makes the whole war pointful is that she ends up winning the battle her own way, right? Because the thing that he has to go and fight this war for, right? You know, he gets it right. She just goes and asks her father, right? And she gets it that way. Right. She also has to be a really clever moment in her question, which is also designed to show who she is, I think, right? That she says, Havali bracha ki eretz hanegev natachani v'natatali gulat mayim. So the question is, right, what does it mean, Havali bracha, give me a blessing, right? The answer is that bracha and brecha, right? In Tanakh, the word brecha is always spelled chaser, meaning well is always spelled chaser, right? So she's actually punning. Right, when she says Havali bracha, Havali brecha, right, give me a well, give me a blessing, they're the same thing. So if you take that as a given, I think that's true. Right, so you have a hint in her language that she's really the clever one, right? And he's just the dumb strong man who goes and fights wars. Right, but it does nothing useful without her. Then you have the story of Dvorah, which is Perek Dalet, right? And the story of Dvorah is all about, right, what the proper relationship between men and women is, right? So Dvorah is the leader. And Dvorah tries desperately to get Barak, right, to go lead this war against the king, right, against the Kenani Melech Arad, right. And she tries and tells him, and Barak refuses to do it unless she goes with him, right. And so finally, right, she tells him, right, he'll do it, but understand that by doing it, right, you're going to mess it, right. You're not going to get any glory because everyone's going to say, right, that. Everyone's going to say that, right, that the war was actually won by women, and the result is that Yael wins the war, right? But wins the war not, right? So you might think that what happened is that's what was going to happen is that Dvorah is going to march at the head of the army, and so, right, so Dvorah is going to be, right, we have a Joan of Arc situation, right, where Dvorah leads the battle, right, and Dvorah replaces Barak. But the answer isn't that, right? What she says, right, that the glory will go to women and not to men doesn't mean that. A woman will perform the military feat that you're supposed to perform, and it means that the war ends up being won by seduction, right? By Yael seducing Sisera and using that as a way of killing his head, of chopping off his head, as opposed to Sisera being defeated in battle. Okay, right. So there's another story, right, in which, right, it seems, right, and the story of Dvorah is a difficult one, because on the one hand, it's clear that Dvorah is a heroine. On the other hand, it's very clear that she's not supposed to be a heroine, and she doesn't even think she's supposed to be a heroine in the way she is. Right? The whole song, right, the whole story of Dvorah is about how wrong it is, right, for, right, women to have to, right, to have to be the military leaders when there are men around to do it. Okay, so in that way, the story of Dvorah is about, right, is another story about the breakdown in social order, right, whereas in Perek Aleph you have what I think is viewed as a proper, right, as a proper vision of social order, right, in which men and women each have power, right, but the men have physical power, which realistically, and the women, right, but it's set up in a culture in which women have the capacity to influence that power in a way, right, because the structure is set up that power isn't the function of physical power, right. In Dvorah, at the beginning of the breakdown, where the men who are supposed to exercise physical power don't do it. And the result is, right, that Dvorah makes fun of Barak, right? Right, and she ends up singing a song about, right, how Yael, right, the whole song, which is a mock epic, right? Because you're supposed to be singing a song like in Homeric in the Odyssey, right? You're supposed to be singing a song about how, right, you put on the arm gauntlets and the, right, and then you put on the chest plate, right, and then you pick up the shield, and then you pick up the spear, right, and then you throw the spear, right? There's a whole long description of what it's like, right, what it's like to fight a battle. Right. Instead, you have this picture, right? You have this picture, right? The heroic epic about somebody picking up a picture, right? Somebody picking up a pitcher of milk when asked for a cup of water, right? In the same tone of voice, right? And she gives him the pitcher of milk, right? And then she picks up the tent peg, right? Right? And she picks him up, right? You know, the whole thing, which is somewhat, right, serious, and I think also somewhat very funny, right? If you know what's supposed to be in heroic songs, right? So this is a heroic, right? So this is a very funny heroic song. Right, if you want a parallel to it, sort of, right, the mock epic was, I think, a common form in certain phrases of English. There's a wonderful poem by Alexander Pope called The Rape of the Lock, right, which is about a guy in love with a particular woman trying to get close enough to her while she's getting made up to cut a lock of her hair. Right, and the whole story is told in this tremendous, you know, heroic tone, right? You know, where he's putting on it, right? You know, he's picking up the scissors, right? Which is described in the same tone as you would have, right, for the weapons of war. You know, and he's creeping in. This is where you get the line, for instance, "Fools rush in where angels fear to tread." Right, that's talking about him actually walking in to her dressing room, Right, with the scissors to see if you can cut it. Right, so there's an example of right of something which is told in the exact same tone of voice as a war epic, but it's hysterical if you understand right. If you understand what it's really about. So I think that Shir HaDvorah can also be read that way. Right, it's a parody of the epic right, of an epic song, and at the same time as it praises everyone, right, it also makes fun of Barak by going through this whole episode. Right, so my contention is that the whole story of Dvorah is the beginning of of the breakdown of the proper social order, which is established in Shabbat in Perek Aleph, right, which is where men fight the wars, but women basically make the wars make sense. Right. So now, right. So the first stage is when women have to fight the wars instead of the men. Then you have in Shabbat in Perek Chet through Perek Tet, we have the story of Gideon and his descendants. Okay, the story of Gideon and his descendants, right? Gideon wins a war, right? At the end of it, we discover this peculiar thing at the end of Perek Chet, that Gideon has 70 sons because he has many wives. The end of that story is that the sons from one of the concubines ends up killing all the other sons as a result of a violent civil war. Okay, following which, he gets killed by a woman. Right, because he comes too close to the wall, and this woman drops a pot on him. Okay, and that's how he dies. That story is explicitly funny, right? Because here's this great war hero, right, who goes and conquers all his brothers, right, and fights this great war, and he's about to conquer the final tower, and a woman drops a pot on him. And a stupid man gets too close to the wall. A woman drops a pot on him, and he dies. Yes. Yeah. The whole thread. The whole story. There are a lot of you know fun puns and metaphors in there. There's a really cool song by Rush, which is built on one of them. Right, but if you want it in the terms I'm setting it up, I think that the point, what goes wrong in the story, is that Gideon has many many wives. Right, it tells you that. What goes wrong is that he has 70 sons from different wives. Okay, and the result of Gideon's right and Gideon's many wives, which implies that he's not in a situation in which women are anything other than baggage, really. Right? Ends up creating a situation in which the men get out of control. And again, the only thing which brings it back to life, right, is that a woman ends up and does the same thing as Yael does, right, and right by killing the stupid men who fight the stupid wars, which started because the men didn't take women seriously. Okay, then I'm going to skip to Perek Yud Gimel. We'll get back to Perek Yud Aleph, which in Perek Yud Gimel is the story of Shimshon and Shimshon and Manoach. Right? There again, you have right, Manoach, and exactly how it fits into the thesis is not 100% clear to me. But that what you have there is a story which is clearly very funny, and it's funny because of the relations between men and women. I think it's fairly clear, right? Where you have the angel keeps on appearing to the woman, who keeps on trying to get her husband to take charge of the situation, right, in which God is, right, in which the angel keeps appearing to her. Her husband is always completely incompetent, right, doesn't get it, right, keeps on asking, right, till the point where, you know, his wife finally gets fed up with him and says, when the angel vanishes in front of him, he says, we're all going to die, and she says, you know, idiot, if you're going to die, why would you bother, you know, we just spent all this time making promises to us, right, so the story of Shimshon's parents is a story, again, in which, right, which is a woman trying to get a man to take charge, right, but it's hopeless, right, because the man has no capacity to do it. They end up producing a son, who has all the physical power in the world and to that degree starts the Yeshuat Yisrael, but on the other hand continually gets undone because he's totally hopeless in the hands of women. There's never any relationship at all, right? It's just totally right. It's all the gender relationships in that story are hopelessly messed up, I think. Although perhaps there's some hope in the notion, right, that he begins, right, Shimshon's an ambiguous figure because although he accomplishes nothing permanent, and he does a lot of damage along the way, nonetheless the narrator thinks that he's the beginning of Yeshuat Yisrael. So my argument would be that you would try and fit that in there somehow by arguing that Shimshon at least begins, right, he lives in a culture which is totally out of control, but he begins to recreate a social order in which, right, men, the physical power of men is to some degree controlled, right, by the influence of women. Although there's so many other things wrong in the story that Shimshon ends up collapsing. Okay, last thing I just want to claim, right, is that so far, everything I've said is my reading of a story, okay, which has certain values. On the other hand, I think it's legitimate from a religious perspective to say, okay, if I, as a 21st century figure, right, read Sefer Shoftim this way, but if I do it with no warrant in tradition, right, so one could legitimately be suspicious of, okay, from a religious perspective, right, do we want to take radical 21st century postmodern readings of a story, right, and use it as the basis of our own religious perspective. So I want to argue, right, that I'm not making it up. Because there is one incredible midrash on Sefer Shoftim, which my argument is, in one line basically, captures everything I've said, and tells you that's what Sefer Shoftim is about. Okay, and that's in a story which is frequently badly misunderstood. The story of Yiftach and his daughter. Story of Yiftach and his daughter, many of you know, right? Yiftach, again, is the son of a concubine, right? The result of him being the son of a concubine is that there's a civil war, right? He gets kicked out, right? That's all, the issue always, right? Concubines in Sefer Shoftim always lead to wars, right? And that might be because they're concubines as opposed to wives, right? Because concubines are inherently powerless. The men who kick him out and are unable to defend themselves, so they bring back, right? They bring back the son of a concubine, or even a prostitute. He's probably actually the son of a prostitute, not a concubine. They bring him back to fight their war. Okay, what he does when he fights the war, he takes a neder. The first living thing coming out of his house is his daughter, and he either sacrifices her or doesn't sacrifice her, which is the same as Machloket Rishonim. Alright, most Rishonim think he actually physically brings her as human sacrifice. Ramban thinks that he simply requires her to remain virgin all her life. Okay, the result of it, right, that's the end of the story of Yiftach. The halachic problem in this story is that there are two halachic problems. Number one, how can a neder be binding, right, to take a life? Right? You're not allowed to take a neder to perform an iser. Okay, that problem the midrash doesn't solve. The second problem is, right, why isn't Yiftach matir neder? Now, why doesn't he just go and say, you know what, had I known when I took this neder that the first being to come out of my house was going to be my daughter, I would never have done it. Right? And he would have come in front of three chachamim, and the three chachamim would have said, you know, that's a really good reason to have charata on your neder. Mutralach, mutralach, mutralach. And the whole story, right, that's how the story should end. Right, that's all. Yes, yeah. Dogs, cats, cows, sheep. Okay. Now one could question, right, whether you think the halachic framework is the appropriate framework for interpreting the story or not. What I'm interested in is what Chazal do with the story. Okay, so Medrash says the following. Medrash says, why didn't Yiftach go and be matir neder? Okay? So the Medrash says, well, the reason that Yiftach didn't was because he was a Nasi, he was prince, right, political leader, and Pinchas was Kohen Gadol. Okay, which we can talk about in a different share. So, Medrash says, well, Yiftach said, I'm Nasi. And because I'm Nasi, so I'm more important than the Kohen Gadol, so the Kohen Gadol should come and be matir my neder. Pinchas said, I'm Kohen Gadol. Kohen Gadol is more important than Nasi. He should come to me to be matir my neder. So they sent messages back and forth saying, you should come to me, you should come to me. And the line that the Medrash uses to climax it, it says, Avein Shnehem Nevda Hanara. And between the two of them, the girl was lost. Okay, meaning that the Medrash interprets that what the story of Yiftach is about is the way in which women suffer, die, right, when men's egos become the controlling aspect of society. Right? Yiftach's daughter dies because both Yiftach and Pinchas are unwilling to allow her as a human being to get in the way of their prerogatives. Okay, my contention is that it's not entirely clear at all that's the point of the story of Yiftach. But the point, the Midrash puts it into the story of Yiftach, right, because it thinks that thematically, right, that's a really good place to put it in, because Yiftach is at the heart of Sefer Shoftim, And right, and if we view the story of Yiftach in the context of Sefer Shoftim, right, this is what Sefer Shoftim is about. Okay, so my argument is that my reading is not actually my original 21st century reading. What it is just an exposition, largely, of that Midrash. Or at the very least, right, it is an expansion of an interpretation which is given by that Midrash. Right, truth in advertising, I should say, my wife disagrees with this entire reading. She thinks that my emphasis on gender is totally off, and that if you look at other aspects of the story, you'll see that what's wrong in Yiftach is it is not gender-specific. What's wrong in the whole Shoftim narrative is the elevation of marginal as opposed to central leaders. But you can ask her about that. I just feel later, since there is a strong opinion, which in any case I would be shot when I went home if I hadn't mentioned. So I will mention that my wife disagrees with me about this. But for what it's worth, right, this is my reading of Sefer Shoftim. It doesn't mean that every element of Sefer Shoftim ties in. Right? It doesn't mean it's the only thing that happens in Sefer Shoftim. But I think the central theme of Sefer Shoftim is this notion that inevitably, in an anarchic political order, the result is the subjugation of women. The result of the complete subjugation of women is, right, is that men run amok in really stupid ways. Right, and the goal is to restore a social order, which isn't the panacea, but at least in a social order, there's a possibility that gender relationships can be restored to a, right, to a fashion which enables a healthy society. Thank you, you've been a great audience. Here they are.